Welcome to Spill Radio. This program is being recorded on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people. I am Tatiana Melema, hosting this program on behalf of the Morris and Helen Belkin Art Gallery at the University of British Columbia. Spill Radio is presented in collaboration with CITR 101.9 FM, with sound production and editing by Joshua Stevenson. Today's episode will include a talk by Teresa Montoya that was presented at the Belkin Symposium Practices of Resistance on February 28, 2019 at the University of British Columbia. Teresa Montoya is currently Provost's Postdoctoral Fellow in the Department of Anthropology at the University of Chicago, where she teaches courses in Native American and Indigenous Studies. Drawing from Diné oral histories as well as ethnographic and archival practice, Montoya's work focuses on legacies of environmental contamination and settler colonialism in relation to contemporary issues of tribal jurisdiction and regulatory politics in the Indigenous Southwest. Her artistic practice critically engages with photography as she uses it to trace millions of gallons of acidic mine waste discharged into the San Juan River that flows across the Navajo Nation. Her work Yellow Water is one of many projects that posit territorial dispossession and environmental toxicity as pervasive features of contemporary Indigenous life, while also affirming how communities are sustained through water in landscapes in which it is scarce. With the presentation of Teresa's talk today, we will begin and end the episode with samples of audio taken from her work Yellow Water that is included in the Spill exhibition.
Our nations throughout the United States. For one, our drinking waters are contaminated with uranium, arsenic. That never comes up in federal testimonies because it's all centered here in the middle of the Navajo Nation and tribal communities throughout the United States. And we need to raise that awareness as well. While the media is here, we want to let our folks know in Washington, D.C., that those need to be addressed. Those waters need to be cleaned. We are here by a mill, a uranium mill. And it took so much advocacy to clean that up. But ladies and gentlemen, there are many other mines throughout the Navajo Nation that have yet to be cleaned up. And they're still open. And every time the wind blows, the particles go up into the atmosphere, and our people are suffering from cancers. And some people say that we don't know how you're getting these cancers. It's from our water, it's from our air. We need to raise that awareness to our federal people in Washington, D.C.
Forged by glacial flows millions of years ago, the San Juan Mountains in southern Colorado remain a mystical landscape to many visitors. The lure of their sky-bound rocky spires, regionally called 14ers, a colloquial title which references their higher than 14,000 feet elevation, draws thousands of tourists annually to explore nostalgic remnants of the so-called Wild West. Silverton, with a population of 650, is the only town in the mountainous San Juan County in southwestern Colorado. Though mining operations in the region formally ended in 1991, the legacy of extraction continues to feed a tourist economy of over 100,000 annual sightseers. Thus, the entire town has since been designated as a National Historic Landmark Site. Nostalgia for an open frontier is seemingly as monumental as the surrounding landscape. Growing up in western Colorado beneath the shadow of another insidious industry, that of uranium extraction, I was familiar with the Ute name Uncompahgre. Only years later, however, would I learn its meaning or visit the places that gave it life. I learned Uncompahgre means redwater spring. The tallest summit in the San Juan Mountains is Uncompahgre Peak, perhaps for the once plentiful hot water springs that flow in nearby Ouray, Colorado. Like Uncompahgre or Ouray, there are dozens of places named by or for original Ute inhabitants of these territories. Such naming, however, does not depict a reverential history. The first ore brought up the granite depths of the Silverton Caldera in the early 1870s effectively legitimized the violent removal of Utes from their homelands located in the San Juan Mountains. The General Mining Act of 1872 laid the framework for settler colonial land seizure. The final blow was sealed with the Bruneau Agreement of 1873, which facilitated the so-called opening of territories through a legal sleight of hand that was orchestrated with the supposed blessing of Ute nations. Processes of eviction and extraction come hand in hand. Hundreds of mining claims, including one now made to the infamous Gold King site in 1887, would be staked as settlers arrived. Following the arrival of the Denver and Rio Grande Railway to Durango in 1881, the railroad began meandering northwards towards the heart of the San Juan Mountains, eventually reaching the valley where a mining camp called Silverton would be incorporated. Along this wandering course, the narrow gauge line repeatedly traverses the Animas River, a tributary of the larger San Juan River. Unsurprisingly then, many regional locales are named for water. For example, Pa means water in Ute, and this title appears in several place names throughout the region, Yampa, Pagosa Springs, even Uncompahgre in its Red Water Spring translation. Similarly, the state name Colorado is translated from Spanish to mean a reddish color, which refers to the ancestral Rio Colorado and the traces of red silt that its waters routinely stir. Today, however, the flowing mountain waters have come to be referenced for another vivid color representing the slow violence of environmental contamination, yellow. On the morning of August 5, 2015, EPA environmental contractors working at the abandoned Gold King mine on Bonita Peak ruptured a retaining wall. A mine reinforcement project became disaster as metal-laden, acidic water gushed into Cement Creek below. 3 million gallons of arsenic, lead, and other metal sulfides rush into the mountain stream. By the afternoon, the yellow plume had reached Silverton. Curiously, the sight of mustard-colored water seemed to be a regular occurrence. An employee at the local museum would later tell me that the water had always appeared characteristically yellow, just in different degrees. As we talked, I noticed books about San Juan mining and boomtown saloons, about ghosts and local lore sitting on the gift shop shelf. She clarified further, as long as I have known, there have never been fish in the water. Always yellow, never fish. And just like that, I realized that toxic mine drainage was normalized there. This was not so for downstream communities. In the hours that followed the rupture, EPA officials scrambled to control the situation, but an official press release would not be distributed until midnight approached. This breach of time, like of the bulkhead wall, would haunt federal officials for months and now years to follow. On the next day, August 6, news began to spread. I found out about the spill from friends on social media after the plume had entered the Animas River and reached Durango. The widely circulated photograph of three kayakers suspended in an orange murky suit became symbolic of a kind of relationship that locals had with the river. The so-called tan color that indexed bygone eras of mining became entangled with the present recreational activities that sustained the local economy today. But absent from this image was another set of relationships that would exceed the imagination of Western legal and regulatory structure. From further downstream, I bore witness to the spill and the lingering traces of its rupture in Dene territories. One by one, irrigation gates were shuttered for Dene communities along the San Juan River, Upper Fruitland, Nananizad, San Juan, Sedacan, Shiprock. Fields of corn, melon, and squash began to weather. Emergency tanks were delivered to offer a bit of relief. But farmers in horror quickly discovered the oily residue in the tank was the same substance extracted from the earth, oil. Their toxic reach is both everywhere and nowhere, a presence that permeates, haunts, and conceals. On a westerly course, the yellow water continued through the Navajo Nation before eventually dissipating into Lake Powell. The following week in Shiprock, New Mexico, the largest Diné farming community along the San Juan River, I attend a public information meeting about the spill. The heat lingers dry and heavy as I came upon the community auditorium. Once inside, I found the space filled with farmers, concerned citizens, journalists, and students. Everyone demands answers. Do not contaminate our farms. What is in the water? I don't want my children to be sterile. What is going to happen when we get sick? If you can't clean it up, don't say that you can, because this water is dangerous and it causes cancer. Navajo Nation officials show graphs of water contamination levels, hoping to reassure community members about this evidence for pending litigation. But these answers do little to satisfy public concerns. When will we be able to farm again? Someone yelled. No one knew at the time that the irrigation channels would remain closed for 9 months, only to reopen the following spring. There were many questions posed, but few were answered. Immediately after the news of the spill broke, state environmental organizations and universities assembled teams to sample soil and water. Soon, the spill revealed as much about the present fissures in bureaucracy and jurisdiction as it did about the fragmentation of indigenous territories. Both continue to reveal the perils of private capitalist industry and state oversight that have functioned without accountability to this land, its people, and our histories. In the subsequent months, while living in the Puerco Valley of northern Arizona, where I was doing research on uranium contamination, I continued to follow the Gold King mine spill and its aftermath. Increasingly, my personal and research responsibilities converged through water. I became more involved in community education and advocacy work with the Diné group Tolpe Nehezil, which means water is our strength. Together, alongside researchers from the Navajo Gold King Mine Spill Exposure Project, we worked to host several community teach-ins designed to share and solicit information about the spill. In these spaces and places, I was reminded how the San Juan River is considered a male entity while the earth is female. In the aftermath of the spill, we confronted the challenge of how to steward this balance through the violence of repeated contamination. As regional sample results, which indicated the river had returned to, quote, pre-spill conditions within weeks of the incident, were released, local anxieties were not easily assuaged. What does it mean when a baseline starts from a point of existing settler colonial contamination? In public meetings, I heard several farmers speak of their customers' hesitance when they attempted to sell them produce that they had been able to save before the water shut off. Some said they could not even sell their tatadine, the yellow corn pollen used for ceremonial purposes. I began to ask myself, what does toxic contamination even look like? The material forms are numerous and insidious. Moreover, how can we visualize and document such toxicity? 6 months after the spill, I walk into the Shiprock Chapter House in the Navajo Nation, where a special meeting was being held to debate the potential reopening of irrigation channels that had been closed since August 2015. My friend Jay and I are late to the meeting as I spent the day on the San Juan River assisting her in a collection of core sediment samples for a university study. Despite the promise of chemical and hydrological data that would soon be interpreted for comparative analysis and shared with community stakeholders, today we only had muddy boots and chapped skin to show for our efforts. Located 100 odd miles downstream from the point of discharge in Silverton, the spill's impact in Shiprock felt just as potent today as it did months prior. The anticipation of the spring season brings both excitement and trepidation when melting snow means increased turbidity in the San Juan River. Unknown quantities of heavy metal-laden sediment that had since settled in the riverbed will soon be churned up once again. A literal and figurative reactivation of trauma from last season's spill. Today, the chapter house is full of residents from Shiprock and the surrounding farming communities along the San Juan River corridor. All chairs are taken so we find a place to sit on the floor against the back wall. One resident stands up and begins asking about the correlation between water clarity and contamination. He asked if the water is more likely to be contaminated when it's muddy. This is a sensible interpretation given all the discussions about turbidity and re-exposure. But then he asks, if the water is clear, then does that mean it is less likely to be contaminated? This question struck with me because it indexed a larger assumption that toxicity is necessarily comprehensible to human perception, especially the visual sensorium. In public discussions such as this irrigation meeting, the appearance of yellow became increasingly synonymous with toxic contamination, not the least because of its ongoing association with uranium yellow cake. But the dissipation of yellow water in the months that followed did not signal the absence of contamination or the anxiety of its effects. Rather, I argue that the correlation between vibrant yellow and toxicity, especially in images circulated in media, obscures the everyday violence of toxic uncertainty experienced by residents themselves, but also reimagines the limits for what even defines toxic exposure. When vibrant yellow becomes the threshold for what is locally understood as toxic, how are other ongoing, less potent discharges understood? How does yellow index an anxiety around ongoing colonial violence? What is the relationship between these? The fog moves through the valley slowly and deliberately as its velvet billows fill in the contours of cragged rock and patches of vegetation. It begins to rain as I quickly retrieve a plastic bag from my jacket pocket and secure it over my DSLR body and lens. I didn't expect the weather to be this cold on an early August morning. Then again, we were pushing 10,000 feet near the confluence of the North Fork and Cement Creek in the San Juan Mountains north of Silverton. I, along with a couple dozen other scientists, journalists, and mining industry professionals, were huddled together as our guide took us on a tour around the Gladstone Water Treatment Plant, established to mitigate acid mine discharge from the Gold King mine spill. It was on this day, exactly 1 year prior, that occurred the largest regional mine spill in recent history. The now infamous Gold King mine spill galvanized a national debate about mining law reform and the role of federal oversight in environmental remediation. At the center of these disputes, plastered across national media headlines, were images of iconic Rocky Mountain landscapes and yellow waterways, symbolic representations of the pure and the polluted. Some were obviously photoshopped to exaggerate the hue of yellow disaster. Such imagery, digitally altered or not, were used to simultaneously advance arguments towards very different ends, either the intentional failure of federal environmental regulation or the necessity for greater federal involvement in the form of Superfund designation. This bill thus marked an imagined crossing of a threshold. However, the definition of this threshold readily shifted depending on who one asks and the relative hue of yellow. As I stood beneath the naked slope, looking upon a cascade of putrid water flowing down from beneath a peak, I raised my camera and eased the frame into focus. Now this looks toxic, I thought to myself as I depressed the shutter. Out of the hundreds of photos I captured for this project, I found myself repeatedly returning to this image. In retrospect, I contemplate how incomplete my casual assessment was, for indeed the visual medium eludes as much as it affirms veracity. From this image, I further refine my inquiry. How does the attempted visualization of toxins both intensify and diminish our capacity to even apprehend toxicity and the settler colonial violence that undergirds its manifestation? I found myself intrigued not only with the composition, but also the colors itself. Dare I say, the image appeared beautiful. In the image, the water appears to emanate from an unseen source. Rubble from prior mining operations lay haphazardly on the slope. The colors of both soil and water are alluring in their otherworldly presentation. This was not the sort of beauty that brought pleasure, but rather the image increasingly stirred in me an unsettled feeling marked by discomfort and disgust. This sort of practice of documentation to raise awareness has often been a comfortable rationale for environmental activists and anthropologists, who act with the justification that, if only the public knew, would certain environmental violence be diminished or halted? This is not true. The belief that such imagery might compel action is rooted within underlying understandings of what effective power lies in the object's apprehension of us viewing the image. And so the tendency to focus on discrete discharges and high-impact spill events obscures what Patrick Wolf theorizes as the enduring structure of settler colonialism. Métis scholar Zoe Todd reminds us to pay careful attention to, quote, how settler colonial states conceive of, relate to, and lay claim to land and water, and how such insights are crucial in providing us with the conceptual and practical tools to refuse and refract the state's understandings of its own doctrines and destinies. Therefore, I return to the question, how does photography of contaminated landscapes expose the limits of understanding toxicity in all its colonial manifestations?
You've been listening to Spill Radio with a lecture and audio work by Teresa Montoya. Please join us next week for a conversation with the artist Carolina Caicedo.